A while since I last preached. I mean, you start getting some rust when you don't do it often and often and often. I was praying and thinking about what I should preach and was wondering if I should maybe step into kind of the same concept that Bill has been going through, these little known characters in the Bible. Although Nehemiah, guy's got a book named after him. It's not necessarily little known, but I thought it'd be better instead to give you come to a passage that's been really impactful for me. More of a kind of get to know you kind of message here. This is a church, that means we're a family. So we're going to get to know each other pretty well. And this passage I'm going to come to has been really been impactful for me in understanding what greatness in the kingdom looks like. And in seminary, it was really, really, really helped me shape it was a major paradigm shift for me in seminary. I'm going to be preaching today on Mark chapter 10. So if you want to turn there, it's Mark chapter 10, 32 through 52. At least for me, this is very impactful, and I think it might be helpful for you, hopefully. If not, if anything, you'll just know a little bit more about me, because that's what sermon's all about, right? It's about the preacher. Just kidding. So, Book of Mark, just to give you some introduction, because I think it's necessary. Book of Mark, it's probably one of my favorite gospels. I don't know if you know this, but it's the shortest of all gospels. Mark he's a master narrator. He's also in a big hurry. So he uses the word immediately like 40 or 60 times in the 16 chapters that he has. He's just on a mission. I want to get this information out. And the reason is he wrote this book to Christians in Rome facing persecution. Very much like the video we just saw. Their lives, nothing was guaranteed. At any moment, someone could break into their house, drag them out, put them in the Colosseum, or do all sorts of crazy things to them just simply because they believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He came and forgave sins, died and rose again. And so Mark is writing this book to Christians in Rome who are facing persecution, asking the question, did I miss something? What's going on? Do I really understand this? And so Mark is trying to get this information out really, really quickly. And he arranges his material in just a masterful way. It's a linear story of the life of Christ, but it's also a theological story of the life of Christ. He's taking pictures and pieces of Christ's life, and he's arranging them together to show and tell something deeper than what you're just reading. And the book's separated into three main movements. The first movement is just about who he is, that Jesus is this Messiah, this Christ. The second movement starts in about chapter 8 and a half, and it's this next chapter about what it means to be a disciple. What is this path of discipleship? Where is Jesus going? And so Jesus is moving from Galilee to Jerusalem, and the last end of the book, after chapter 10, is Jesus' passion, what he's done on the cross, what he did for us. And so we're going to focus in on that second portion of the book at the very end of it. Chapter 10. And as you get into chapter 10, just to give you a little bit more context, and I promise I'm going to get into the message here, and this is not normal. I don't usually take this much time to get into where we're going, but I think it's very important. Chapter 10 starts with this discussion about divorce. And then there's this discussion like that Jesus has with his disciples, or these children trying to come up to Jesus, and they're trying to push him off. They're like, no, he's got other more important things to do. You guys stay over here, do your childlike things, and us adults are going to talk with Jesus because we're the important ones. And Jesus speaks to them and says, no, let the children come to me. It's verse 14, chapter 10. Do not hinder them, for such belongs the kingdom of God. Truly I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God like a child shall not enter it. And so he takes them and he blesses them. And then we move right from that into the story of a rich young ruler. And this guy comes up and he's like, teacher, tell me what I need to do to inherit eternal life. And Jesus is like, well, just do the Ten Commandments. He's like, no, I've done that since my childhood. I've done it. I'm good. And he's like, okay, well, you got one thing you're lacking. Sell all that you have. Give it to the poor. Follow me. And the text says the guy walked away sorrowful because he had a lot of stuff. That's my translation, Andrew's translation. And the disciples are a little confused by this. They're like, well, if the rich guy can't get into the kingdom, what hope do we have? And Jesus speaks to them, you know, with man, not all things are possible, essentially, but with God, all things are possible. And he's speaking to them, and he's starting to shift and to change a mindset with the disciples that they don't necessarily understand, that they've got things flipped upside down. They're holding on to a worldly system of success and acceptance before God, and they don't get it. And in this gospel, Mark is speaking to the believers in Rome and using these disciples to illustrate the fact that our understanding of success, our understanding of greatness, our understanding of position is off if we're following the world's definition. So right after this, we get into where we're going to be, and Jesus foretells his death for the third and final time in the book. So the book of Mark, Jesus gives a declaration of that what he's going to do. He's going to go and he's going to die. He does that three times. Each time he reveals a little bit more and more specific and more specific and more specific. And right here is the most specific he gets talking to the 12 disciples. And he says to them, and they were on the road going up to Jerusalem. And Jesus was walking ahead of them and they were amazed. And those who followed were afraid. And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what had happened to him, what was to happen to him, saying, see, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles, and they will mock him and spit on him and flog him. So I don't know how more clear you can be. He's like, guys, I'm going to Jerusalem. I'm going to die. This is what's going to happen. I'm going to give it over to religious leaders who aren't concerned about the things of God. They want to kill me because I stand against what they want. And it's going to happen. I'm going to be condemned and I'm going to die. Now, as you're reading the story, I mean, if you're sitting in their room with these disciples, you'd be thinking, okay, well, they're like, no, that's not going to happen. We'll protect you or whatever. But that's not what happens in the story here. And Mark arranges this information in a very specific way just to showcase where these disciples are. And he says to them, and it says this, verse 35, and James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to him and said to him, teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. And as you're reading, you're just like, what? I mean, throughout all the Gospels, the disciples are pretty dense. I mean, and really we are too, but it is. They're pretty dense. And Jesus goes, hey guys, we're going to Jerusalem. We're almost there. We're almost to Jericho. I'm about to be given over and I'm going to be condemned to death. I'm going to die. Cool, Jesus. We want you to do something for us real quick, if that's okay. Okay, well, what do you want from me? What do you want me to do for you? Verse 37, he says, grant us to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your glory. See, these disciples didn't hear a word that Jesus said. They weren't listening to what he was saying. They were assuming what Jesus was going to do was come and triumph and establish his kingdom. And what James and John wanted, they wanted to come up and they wanted positions of authority and power. Let me sit on your right hand and on your left hand. What does that mean? But they're thinking along the lines of Caesar. He's got a right hand man and a left hand man. And these guys do his bidding. Caesar says, I want this done. They go do it. I want you to go up into Turkey, take them out. They'll go do it. And those guys take that message out to the armies, and they tell the armies what to do. They tell the people what to do. And so they're standing with this authoritative responsibility from Caesar in order to levy out commands to people. It's a position of prominence. It's a position of authority. It's a position where life is good and easy because we're eating at the king's table all the time. Everything's good. And so they're seeing, they're walking and like, okay, well, things are about to get intense. We better ask this question before the other guys ask this question. And they come up and they ask Jesus. And so Jesus responds to them and he says, you don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism which I am baptized? And they said to him, we're able. And Jesus said to them, the cup I drink, you will drink, and the baptism which I'm baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand and my left hand is not mine to grant, but it's for those who've been prepared. And when the ten heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. Now, I don't know about you, but growing up, we used to take family vacations on car trips. How many years is that? 25 years ago, that was a little expensive to fly in a plane, especially for a pastor's family. So we'd all pile up in our van and we'd drive around. And there was always some point in the trip where one of the kids would notice that there's only one Oreo left or one bag of Doritos. And quickly go, hey, mom, can I get the Oreo? I'm like, oh, yeah, sure, here you go. And the other kids are just sitting there seething because they knew what they did. You've had 10 Oreos already. I've only had 4. Because that person took the last of the good thing. And so you can imagine what these other disciples are doing. They're sitting there. They're going, oh, what are we going to get? I mean, they got the good 2 right hand. There's no other right hand and left hand position. There's not a right of the right. Now they're going to be telling us what to do. What is this? We're missing out. They're all grumbling, complaining about what's going on. Because they're viewing greatness in a worldly way. See, a worldly view of greatness results in a desire for position and power. If you're taking notes, here's point 1. A worldly view of greatness results in vying for position and power. I'll say it again. A worldly view of greatness results in a desire for position and power. And that's what they're doing. But Jesus responds to them. He called them and he said to them, you know, this is verse 42, you know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. But whoever be great among you must be your servant. And whoever be first among you must be slave to all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. And Jesus goes right at it because he knows exactly what they're thinking. You're thinking I'm coming in to be the new Caesar. I'm not doing that. I'm already king of the universe. I'm the reason Caesar's alive right now. I'm coming to give my life up to serve and be a ransom for many so that I can rescue my people out of the death that they're in. And if you're going to follow me and you're going to be great in my kingdom, it's not going to be because you're sitting in the choice seats saying, having the authority over people. It's because you're willing to step down and serve. Let me just give you 2 examples here. Let's just imagine yourself if you were going to be a pastor. God called you into ministry. So you get done with seminary, you go with your wife, you go in your house, you're like, okay, we don't know what to do, but let's just start a Bible study. And so you start a Bible study in your home, and 18 short years later, that Bible study has grown to a church with over 10,000 members coming. Not only that, there's multiple locations. Not only multiple locations, but there's multiple church plants that have already come out and grown up and are stable. And along the way, you've started a couple of nonprofits, parachurch ministries. You've written a couple books, and you've even made appearances on national TV, and you're on that national circuit of preaching. Now, would you look at that and say, man, that person is a successful pastor? It's not a trick question. Yes, yes. We would look at that and say, that guy's successful. Right? That's awesome. We wish our church would be like that. Now let's reframe that again. Let's say instead, not a pastor, but you had this invention that you came up with in your basement. You know what? I think this could work. I think I could produce this. I think this would be helpful for people. And so you start your own little business. And you work it out of your basement. And in 10 short years, or 18 short years, you now have over 10,000 employees. You're making a dent in the world's economy. You've been asked to sit on the board of like Google or Apple or Microsoft, depending on where you are with the technology. You've written a couple of books on leadership and finance. You're on the top of Fortune 500. Is that successful? Again, not a trick question. Yes, that would be successful. Now let's just compare those two examples. What's the difference? What's the difference between those two? Well, God is the difference, but when we look at it at face value, there is no difference. One person successful in one way in one area, another person successful in another area. And we're looking at that with outside eyes saying that is success. Now, this is not to shame or condemn someone, but this is just because it's out there. But that first image is exactly what happened in Mark Driscoll's church. Mars Hills Church in Seattle went a long way until 2014 when he resigned from his position. After it had found out that he had quite recently fired elders, whoever had a dissenting opinion from him, surrounded himself with yes men, changed the church bylaws so that he could levy his decisions over top of people in a quicker manner, took $250,000 of church money and used it to buy a book that he wrote so he can become a New York Best Times seller, and then took that and leveraged that position for a 7-year book deal. Now, Mark, as far as I can understand, has repented. It seems like he's tracking with the Lord again. And again, I don't use this to shame him at all. It's just an example of what can happen to us when we start changing around in our mind, flipping and trading worldly view of greatness for a godly view of greatness. And what started out with a good reason and a good desire eventually became less about the kingdom of God and more about the kingdom of Mark. And as a result, thousands of Christians were hurt deeply. And man, how much could we have used Mars Hills Church in Seattle this last year? It's damaging. Because a worldly view of greatness vies for as a desire for position and power. But a godly view of greatness results in following Christ in the sacrificial service. A godly view of greatness results in following Christ in the sacrificial service. See, Mark switches gears here. And it's almost like the climax. It actually is the climax of this portion, this section in the book of Mark. Right, we're in the second section leading up into Jesus' passion. And he shifts the focus and looks at this man named blind Bartimaeus. This is the last healing in the book of Mark. It's the last of three healings of blind people. And out of all of the healings in the book of Mark, this one is the only one where a man is named by name. It says, they came to Jericho, and as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a great crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside. And he names Bartimaeus by name. Not only does he name him by name, but he gives him his father's name. So there's no mistaking who this person is. And he was sitting by the roadside, or actually in the Greek it says on the way, which is also the same phrase in 32 when it says when they were on the road or they are on the way. So this phrase in Mark is called on the way, is a phrase that speaks to the path of discipleship. I wish the translator would have just put it on the way every single time so our eyes can see it. But Bartimaeus is sitting on the side of the way. And when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out saying, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. And then many rebuked him, telling him to be silent. But he cried out all the more, son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus stopped and said to him, call him. And they called the blind man, saying to him, take heart, get up, he's calling you. Now what was happening there? There's a blind man, lowest of the low in society, can't take care for himself, can't take care of himself, probably smells really bad, clothes are pretty raggedy, you know, just really an annoyance. He says, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. And the crowd's going by, they're like, this guy wants an audience with the king we're following? No. We're the important ones, we're going to stay up here. Stay back. And Jesus says, no, bring him up here. He's like, okay, fine. All right, Bartimaeus, he's calling you. Come on up here. And the guy, look at what happened. Verse 50, it says, throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. Now, I don't know if you know very much about blind beggars in the first century. I'm sure there's a lot of experts here. But the beggars used to use their cloaks to gather money. They take it, laid over their laps so people can throw the coins in there so they can collect it because they're blind. And they don't need to be sitting down in the dust trying to figure out where's the coins that were dropped. They need a place to gather it so they can pick it up and hold it. It's much like a street musician in their guitar case or a hat or something. This is what they're using. And Bartimaeus doesn't gather up his cloak and the money that's in it. It says he threw it off and he sprang up. What did he just do there? He gave away his worldly possessions, exactly. He gave away his ability to make an income. He gave away probably his only covering for a cold night. Just dropped it. I don't care. I know there's a crowd around here. Someone can take it. Probably wouldn't because it's maybe not the nicest piece of clothing out there, but I don't want it. If he's calling me, anything that's stopping me from doing it, I'm running after him. And this sits in stark contrast with that rich young ruler. Give all your possessions, give it to the poor, follow me. Bartimaeus, I don't even have to be asked. I don't need this stuff. Jesus is calling me. So he gets up and he goes to Jesus, and Jesus says to him, verse 51, what do you want me to do for you? That phrase, same phrase that he said to James and John. No difference in the Greek. Mostly no difference in the English, depending on your translation. What do you want me to do for you? Rabbi, let me recover my sight. And Jesus said to him, go your way. Your faith has made you well. And immediately he recovered his sight and followed him on the way. It's the blind man sitting on the side of the road, the outcast of society, is the one who's able to truly see who Jesus is. It's the blind man that truly understood what was valuable in this world. It's the blind man not sitting there going, oh, this is my opportunity. Let me recover my sight, put me in a position of power. Let me sit in your right hand or your left hand. Make life easy for me. He says, no, you're able to make me see. And the disciples are the ones who have vision but can't see. And Mark points out in a very, very clear and beautiful way that if what you want to get your name for yourself in the kingdom, you walk with the same mind frame as Bartimaeus. Jesus is the one with the true value. Jesus is the one that you seek after. Even when people are pushing you aside, go after Christ. You don't need anything if you have him. And if you're with him, he's able to heal you, redeem you, and put you on a path of discipleship so you walk and start to look like him. The problem is it's not necessarily cased in most of our churches. It's not my mind frame most of the time. It's so easy to get caught up with having a good position, having a good paycheck, having a good parking spot, getting the right office, having a better car than your neighbor, and jumping on this game and this trying to climb this ladder of success. But that's not what greatness in the kingdom looks like. You're not climbing the ladder. You're supposed to hold it for someone else. You're supposed to give up so that someone else might be like blind Bartimaeus and come to see Jesus and actually be able to see. So if a worldly view of greatness results in a desire for position and power, but a godly view of greatness results in sacrificial service following Christ, what are we to do? Well, I think we start by just defining greatness by self-denying sacrificial service to God. Look, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be great. To want to be excellent, wanting to excel and use your life and invest it in the best way possible. It's a good and God-honoring thing. The problem results when we start investing it into the wrong bucket. We start using worldly metrics to define how we're doing. If we would just wake up every single day and say, you know what, Lord? I've got things that I want to do. I got things that are responsibilities that I need to do. Some of those responsibilities revolve me getting praise of people. Lord, would you help me not to listen to the deception and the temptation of that praise? Lord, would you give me eyes to see the people around me that I can serve? Who's hurting? Who are having trouble? Let me step in to help them, to pray for them, to uplift them, call to mind people who've shared burdens with me that I can intercede for them today when nobody knows. Look, I'm not saying this to say you guys don't serve. From what I hear, this seems to be a very serving church. I'm just hearing story and story. Actually, just recently, guys from this church just got up together and helped three people since I've been here move. That's not normal. I guess for you it is, yeah. That's not normal. I talked with someone who I met up in Doylestown after we moved our stuff into our storage units and said, yeah, that was awesome. That was awesome. There's a bunch of people there. We got it done in like 45 minutes. So they were like, yeah, that's because you're paid staff. I was like, well, I hope that's not the case. And the Lord showed, no, that's not the case. This is the heartbeat of this church. This is good leadership from Bill. So I'm not saying this to say you guys need to serve more. What I am saying this is a reminder Because all of us have a propensity to have our mind shift. I don't know about you, but I feel like everything I've learned of the Lord, when I fall asleep, I lay down the pillow, it all just drains out into the pillow. And I wake up every day just going, man, I don't know anything. It's all about me. I'm hungry. I need my coffee. I need this. And I got to renew my mind into who I am and whose I am. What am I here for? There's a lot of preachers out today preaching a message which you can probably guess what it's going to be. There's an important date coming up, not just Ann's birthday. And there's a lot of fear and a lot of terror about what's going to happen in the results of this election. But my hope is just to remind you we are of a different kingdom. We are of a different world. We are ambassadors on a visa to this place, called to steward what we have here and to work for the betterment and human flourishing around us. But this is not our home. So whatever comes there does not stop what our responsibility is. To serve sacrificially, following Jesus wherever he calls you to go, whoever he brings you to. Our job's not to sit here critique other Christians. Our job's not to sit here critique what's going on. Our job is to serve, to pray. And quite honestly, Bill said this at Gene's funeral. I'm sure he said this multiple times. We won't really know who the great ones in the kingdom are until we get there. And when the Lord's handing out his gifts, which I don't even really understand that concept, how do you live in perfection and still get more stuff? How does that work? But there are going to be some quiet old ladies with worn out knees in a closet. Nobody knows they're praying. Receiving commendation after commendation for being great in this kingdom. We all have an opportunity to be great in God's kingdom. It's whether or not we're going to take our focus off of ourself and our success, put it on Christ. So focus in on Jesus. Love you guys. Worship team.